The sorry shape of our roads and highways are not a surprise to anyone who drives in the islands, but a recent review from Civil Engineers gives us poor grades for our storm drains, wastewater, and drinking water systems. HPR's Wayne Yoshioka joins us live with the latest. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. The American Society of Civil Engineers, the local chapter, issued their first report card on the state's infrastructure, and the Civil Engineers gave Hawaii an overall grade of D.
That's pretty bad.
D plus. The roads got D plus and the bridges got a C plus. So at least that's a passing grade. And the roads and bridges, you know, they really impact most of the residents. I mean, with the major morning and afternoon rush hour traffic congestion and all that. Civil Engineer Stephen Du co-chaired the report card committee and had this to say about our bridges and roads.
Hawaii's bridges are on average 60 years old, which is significantly older than the national average of 43 years old. Of these bridges, 6.9% are structurally deficient. For our roads, we earned a D+. Hawaii's roadway network is essential for handling multiple modes of transportation, from pedestrians to bicyclists and passenger vehicles, all the way to heavy loads of high-volume freight trucks and buses. However, usable land in the state is very limited, and many roadways are confined by existing developments and or the natural topographic features. Meanwhile, roadway travel demand statewide is projected to continue to increase from 2.4 million daily vehicle trips from 2007 all the way to 3.4 million daily vehicle trips by 2035.
You know, Catherine, when we were working at KITV, the number one complaint with the Office of Information and Complaint at City Hall was potholes.
Right, absolutely. And,
and here we have Civil Engineer Amber Takeno-Uchi. She co-chaired the report committee and provided recommendations from the Civil Engineers Organization.
The state legislature should increase the state gas tax and help support innovative funding mechanisms. Over the next 20 years, there's a funding gap of $23 billion for transportation infrastructure. Additional revenue will help to reduce this gap and address the growing construction costs. New revenue can also help toward paving the potholes, managing congestion, and reducing the number of structurally deficient bridges that we have here in Hawaii.
So what do you think? I mean, the state and county already raised the vehicle weight tax and the registration fees. Over the last 2 years, the state levied a rental car surcharge a couple of years ago, but they're not done. They found a pot of money. There's Senate Bill 409 that proposes to levy a $15 a year charge on electric vehicles for the use of our roads and bridges. Senator Russell Ruderman was the lone Democrat voting no on the measure, and this is what he said.
And now that we have 2.5% of our cars are electric vehicles and almost 4% are hybrids, we're going to put the brakes because road fees are more important than climate change. It's been said that electric vehicles need to pay their fair share because they're so heavy and they do damage to the roads. Electric vehicle is lighter than the average SUV. It's much lighter than an empty pickup truck. And road damage, it has an exponential relationship to the weight of a vehicle. 90% of the damage to a road comes from the heaviest truck that goes down it that day. 9% comes from the second heaviest vehicle that goes down it. And 1% comes from all the other vehicles put together. It's not a good reason to do this.
So if you do the math, you know, 3,000 electric vehicles times $15, that's only $45,000. Why do this? Well, you've got to get it passed first, and then you can incrementally raise it over the years, and it'll be just like having a gas car.
Well, I have to agree with him because we have both gas cars and electric vehicles in our family, and that little smart car is very light.
Yes, it is. And, you know, they have charging stations. There's a lot. They have a lot of amenities that a gas-powered car doesn't have, and yet the gas-powered cars are paying for the bulk of the highway repairs.
Right, and getting back to the proposal to raise the gas tax, we know that the State Department of Transportation has lobbied to raise fees, their user fees, right, the vehicle weight tax, registration, because they said that, yeah, the funds are going down, and they need to be able to sustain the work that they do on those roads, so they need to find the money somewhere.
And they also are proposing to have another lane put in the zipper lane and have fees for people who want to buy permits to use the zipper lane.
Is that the congestion pricing?
I guess so. But, you know, they're trying to look for all kinds of money, but, you know, the roads are just in really disrepair, and we don't know if it's a state road or a county road. I mean, how are you going to differentiate? And so it's going to be really difficult for them to raise this kind of money to fix our roads.
And we have then the unexpected challenges of landslides like we saw in the Pali, you know, hearing today that now that the issues are going to continue through August.
Through August. I mean, that's going to be a big repair. I mean, people on the windward side, there's really no way to get there, to get to Honolulu, unless they go around, you know, Hawaii Kai, or they go up north. But, you know, the H3 is already congested. And if you have to work downtown, you got to make that Red Hill traverse, and it's just a bear.
Right. And we had a Department of Transportation officials in. They were exploring different things. I think they are planning a series of meetings to roll out to kind of explain to the community why they are asking for these fees, that they have to do this over the long haul in order to sustain the road work that needs to be done on our highways.
And when you think about it, what happens when rail comes in and the vehicle use, well, might go down? I mean, who's going to pay for the road maintenance and repair? It's going to be a smaller pool of people, maybe, or, you know, it's going to be a lot bigger burden for them.
And we did have some discussions with DOT about, you know, potentially changing the mix of the asphalt that they're currently using. I think that's something that they're working on. I know the city has been, I guess, experimenting with some sealants in some neighborhoods. So I'll be kind of curious to see how well those are holding out.
And we also remember the debacle about the pothole machine that they bought for a couple of million dollars that never worked. I mean, this remains to be seen. But getting back to the report now, you know, the Honolulu Department of Environmental Services sent out an email, you know, saying that it was full of inaccuracies, the report card, and then they recalled it. But we have to remember that for the civil engineers, it's in their benefit to give the government bad grades, because that's what they do. That's their job.
Ideas they'll get, maybe get more money than to make those repairs. But that report also looked at everything from storm drain issues, how we deal with wastewater and drinking water. So we are in line for some upgrades for our Board of Water Supply pipes, and we will have to pay for that down the road.
And it's going to be expensive.
Yes, that and, we know.
Thank you.
All right, thanks so much, Wayne. That was HPR's Wayne Yoshioka. You can find his stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday Backyard Quiz. The Hawaiian silver sword, known by its Hawaiian name, ahinahina, which means very gray, is an exceptionally rare and endangered plant unique to Hawaii's volcanoes. Because it only grows at altitudes of 5,000 and 10,000 feet, it is thoroughly adapted to the harsh environment of its home. The plant itself has dense rosettes of spiky leaves that radiate from its base. Now, those leaves are a silvery, light green color and often appear almost metallic. However, the plant's most striking feature is in its towering blooms that can reach up to 6 feet in length. Now, the bloom stalk of the silver sword is a true sight to behold, often taller than its observer, and adorned with 100 or more purple flowers. What makes the blooming of a silver sword even more special is that the plants are they last up to about 50 years, but they bloom only once, and then they die. If you get a chance to see one, be sure to snap a picture. And today, we're wondering what the genus family the silver sword's in. Do you know it? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag. that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Island Insurance, and Sacred Hearts Academy.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Argosy University is expected to permanently close its doors today. The private university has 22 campuses around the country, including three in Hawaii. Now, earlier this week, Argosy said it would likely cease operations at the end of this week, sending students and faculty scrambling. Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
Aloha is alive at Argosy University, Hawaii.
At Argosy University's downtown Honolulu campus this week, confusion and frustration were more common than aloha. On Thursday, the school held two transition fairs for students to help them plan for the closure. Jamie Swinney is one of those students.
I had literally 3 weeks left until I would have been done.
Jamie is a Marine Corps veteran from Oahu working on his bachelor's degree. He says news of Argosy's closure took him by surprise.
They haven't really been keeping us informed here, but I've been getting emails and stuff, and mostly online. So I Googled Argosy University online yesterday, and I saw that the schools would close by tomorrow if we didn't get a buyer. But yeah, I mean, it seems like fishy stuff's been going on for like the past year, and nobody's really been paying attention to it. They've been firing a lot of the staff. My stepdad, who's a veteran, he used to work here. They laid him off. They laid off a lot of the academic advisors. So it came down to the last session. I didn't even know who to talk to had classes because they were just laying everybody off, telling us, oh, it's going to be okay. We're still in receivership for a year, saying that, you know, we'd be able to finish the program at least, or else I would have transferred last year. And then now I'm running around, like, trying to scramble to get everything worked out by tomorrow, really.
Like many Argosy students, Jamie is paying for school with the GI Bill. Many student veterans rely on the GI Bill to pay their monthly living expenses. Argosy's closure has thrown them into uncertainty.
I know I'm comfortable because I know I still have at least some of the GI Bill left that I'll be able to finish at least the bachelor's degree, and then hopefully I have time to figure something out, but it's just changed a lot of the plans. Like I said, my roommate, he doesn't have another income besides the monthly housing allowance from the GI Bill, so I don't know how we're going to get through the lease unless I start paying more.
In January, a federal judge transferred ownership of Argosy to a neutral third party, a process called receivership. The university's original owner is a Pennsylvania-based nonprofit called Dream Center Education Holdings. In 2017, Dream Center purchased Argosy and several other for-profit colleges around the U.S. and converted them to nonprofit status. In a written statement, the company's court-appointed receiver said, "We have been working day and night since the institution entered receivership to find the best path for students at Argosy University, Hawaii, and are doing everything we can to save the campus." The receiver said it's working with students, accreditors, state and federal regulators to provide as many options as possible for transfers and for dealing with student loans. Those student loans and the transfer of credits have attracted national attention, including from the American Psychological Association.
Our best estimates is it's over 1,000, probably about 1,200 that are currently active students in an Argosy doctoral psychology program.
That's Catherine Gruss. She's the chief education officer for the American Psychological Association.
We are certainly very concerned for the students that are currently training in those programs. There's currently 8 open accredited programs that are operated by Argosy University. They're dispersed all over the United States. They offer doctoral training in psychology. A typical program, generally it takes usually about 5 to 6 years to complete your doctoral training. So it's a significant investment of time, and for many students, it's a significant investment of funds.
And those expenses add up. According to the Department of Education, the doctoral psychology program at Argosy Hawaii costs more than $60,000 in tuition and fees, and that's after an undergraduate degree. Zena Ewing is one of those doctoral students at Argosy's Honolulu campus. She was about to complete her dissertation when news of the closure hit.
So it's kind of a giant mess with the internship people. So everyone who's on internship now is going into internship next year should be able to get their degrees. I don't know about anybody else yet, so we're just kind of waiting.
Zena is about to start her clinical internship and should be able to finish her degree. But students who aren't as far along in the program may not be so lucky. Some may need to start over entirely. That bothers Zena.
The people here have been really like straightforward with us and really open about it, but I think like in general, Argosy has not been very forthright about things. Like they told us yesterday at 2 p.m. about the info sessions today and that we'd be closing on Friday. And I feel like they had to have known in advance of Wednesday that they're closing on Friday. So I think it just doesn't feel quite kosher.
For Zena, the one bright spot in the whole experience has been the response of faculty members at Argosy Hawaii.
Most of them actually are really more worried about the students, and they're mad on our behalf, which has been really cool. Like, I know they're worried about whether or not they're going to continue to have their health insurance and that kind of benefits, but most of them are just really mad that this is happening to us, which is really cool. So they've been really bending over backwards, trying to get us to get everything together, and just been really supportive. So that's been really cool to see.
In fact, some of the psychology professors will be working pro bono after Argosy closes so that Zena can defend her dissertation, a critical requirement for graduation. Lance Lincoln also had praise for the local faculty, who helped organize transition fairs for Argosy students to figure out their options.
The faculty and staff at Argosy have done everything that they can, I feel, to help the students. They put this thing together. Other schools probably didn't have these things. I didn't read any newspaper where they had these kinds of things that took place. We're lucky we're in Hawaii that they have the aloha spirit.
Lance is a native Hawaiian graduate student, originally from Waianae. For him, the school's closure is about more than just completing his degree.
I mean, overall, I'm going to be okay, but I mean, it's very debilitating, you know, like, to think about, like, I mean, I really got along with a lot of these students. This was like family to me, and I was here all the time, and I really like coming here and seeing the students, and now, and the faculty, and now everything's just, like, come to a sudden end. Like, we're going to come here tomorrow, the doors, I didn't think it was just going to end like this. I mean, I thought we'd continue to be able to go to school, but just Wednesday, we got an email, no class, no nothing. And then that's a guarantee tomorrow the doors is going to be closed.
But Lance isn't letting the situation get the best of him. And he has a message for his fellow students.
These kinds of things just happen. You know, don't get discouraged and just keep trying to seek for your dreams and strive for the highest. You know, like Native Hawaiians, like we have this saying, kulia ikonu, which means to strive for the highest. You know what I mean? We're striving for the highest, striving to reach the highest breadfruit branch. And we try to reach the highest, which is the PhD. So I would just encourage students to just keep, especially Native Hawaiian students, to just keep, you know, fighting a good fight and to kulia ikonu, and I mean to strive for the highest and try to acquire that PhD.
Students can request their transcripts from Argosy University via mail at no charge. Those transcripts will also be on file with the State Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
In a statement issued just this morning, the U.S. Department of Education said, while the court has not yet granted the receiver's motion to close the campuses, we recognize that an imminent closure is a distinct possibility. Students should know that despite the actions of the receiver, the Education Department is working quickly to provide students the information and resources that they need to either have their loans discharged or to find another institution where they can finish their program should the school close. We'll have a link with more information for students posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you have an experience with Argosy or any other school closure, we want to hear about it. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 and leave us a message. This is The Conversation from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Honolulu Police Department has been operating under a cloud since the indictment of its former chief, Louis Kealoha, in a public corruption probe. Now, Honolulu Civil Beat has a story about another scandal involving test fixing. That's the subject of our reality check segment. Brittany Light joins us from their Kaimuki studios. Morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
So this is an old lawsuit, right? I mean, it's been around for a while.
It's a decade-old lawsuit, and it's been publicized, especially back in 2017 when Susan Ballard was sworn in as the chief. This came up, and it never really had an effect, as you know, on her being named the chief. And now it's sort of coming back. It's scheduled to be voted on, this proposed settlement.
That's today, right?
That's today, yes. The Honolulu City Council is scheduled to vote on a pending $500,000 settlement in this 10-year-old lawsuit. And it alleges that Police Chief Ballard played a role in altering test scores of some police academy recruits back in 2008.
So who filed this lawsuit?
So the lawsuit, it was filed by Deanne Koenui, who was a sergeant at the time. She filed the suit in 2009. And what the complaint claims is that Koenui faced retaliation and harassment for being vocal about altered test scores and for reporting it to the Internal Affairs Division.
So this then happened when Ballard was in charge of that division?
Exactly. So back when she was supervising at the academy.
And so any response from the chief?
No response from the police department at this time. They didn't want to comment until everything is finalized with this settlement. The city council's Executive Matters and Legal Affairs Committee has recommended that the council today, vote in favor of this $500,000 settlement. So it'll be interesting to see what the response is. I think the question is, does this lend any culpability on behalf of the chief for some of the allegations here?
Right, because a lot of folks, were hoping that there would be a change in direction given what we've seen with the indictments with the police department. So lots of hope riding on this new chief.
It's true, yes. And two of the police commission members back in 2017, they said they were aware of these allegations at that time, but that they didn't dissuade them. The allegations didn't dissuade them from supporting Ballard to become the police chief, and that there wasn't any evidence showing that she and others had actually altered test scores. So it'll be interesting to see if some evidence did come out in that time.
Now, the lawsuit claims that, some tests were shredded? Some evidence was destroyed?
It also claims that some of the tests were shredded so that there wouldn't be any evidence of the changing in the scores. Yes.
So that's, those are serious allegations. But I imagine, though, with the settlement that the folks just want this to go away.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see. I think folks will perhaps be more willing to talk about this today after the council has its vote.
Now, those matters in executive session, I think those are generally done behind closed doors, though, right? So there isn't a lot of open discussion
about it. I don't know that there will be much open discussion, but I think once the vote is made, if this proposed settlement is finalized, I think folks will be more willing to address it.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see, if anyone from the police department shows up, if they're asked any questions. I know the chief was out of town. I don't know if she's back.
I believe she's out of town, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, it will be interesting to see, like you said, what they finally vote on and what they will say publicly about this settlement. $500,000, big number.
Yeah, it's sizable, yeah.
All right, thanks so much, Brittany.
Thanks, Catherine.
Appreciate your story. That was reporter Brittany Light with today's reality check. Check out her story at civilbeat.org.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine joins us to talk about sending humans to the moon and Mars, mining asteroids, and the role of companies like SpaceX in the future of American spaceflight. We'll be answering your questions, too. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
Tourism officials unveiled their spring marketing strategy Wednesday, and we continue our conversation about how to manage the industry as people are starting to question if the negatives are starting to outweigh the pluses. In the past week, we've heard from legislative policymakers from Oahu and the Big Island. Today, we talked to one of the newest county council members on Maui. Tamara Palton worked face-to-face with our visitors as an ocean safety officer and shares her perspective.
I feel like I was working on the front lines of tourism. I was an ocean safety officer at D.T. Fleming's Beach Park on the Upper West Side. So I interacted with tourists nearly every day. And we have a lot of tourists coming to West and South Maui. It allows for us to have kind of a good deal of revenue to come into our county, but we're kind of straining at our infrastructure with us not getting back the full THC amounts like how it was before the cap. It's almost becoming more and more of a burden. Recently, they built a big, like a $300 million parking garage for rental cars at the airport. And, you know, it kind of seems like a good idea because the rental cars were just parked all over the place. But it set us up a little bit to clog our roads from Central Maui to West Maui and Central Maui to South Maui. You can really tell when it's tourist season, especially winter break, summer break, and spring break. The roads to and from West and South Maui get really clogged and back up more so than normal.
Those lines over there at the Maui airport, unreal.
To me, it would be great if we could find more of a way to spread the tourism out throughout the year. But part of it can be, you know, trying to encourage more tourism during the off season rather than keep promoting, you know, the standard times when tourists come. I think over here on Maui, originally we were going after kind of the more high-end tourists than, say, other places, because a lot of our hotels are high-end and cost the RevPAR, the nightly room rates are quite high. But you kind of are hearing that more hotels more hotels are wanting to be built here. And with the current infrastructure the way it is, it's kind of a scary thought.
You folks just recently had a landslide also there on Maui. How did that affect things?
The one in the Upper West Side, not too much, because you know, it's past the last of the hotels on the west side. The Ritz-Carlton is our last hotel on the Upper West Side, and the landslide was further on Highway 30 than that hotel, although a lot of tourists do like to take that scenic route and, you know, see all the you know, the winding rural countryside. I do have some friends that live in Honokohau Valley, which is, you know, in the general vicinity that the road was cut off. And I let them know that the road was going to be shut down only to residential tourists. And one of my friends were like, great, can we keep it like that all the time? Because they're constantly getting, you know, a stream of tourists going through their area, which is kind of a rural area off the grid. They see, like, you know, the constant stream of tourism is a little bit of an intrusion to their lifestyle.
So in their mind, the negatives are starting to outweigh the positives.
Yeah, they like it. You know, and I don't know if it's because of the Maui Revealed book or, you know, just the volume of tourists coming. A lot of tourists have been going into areas that aren't traditionally been set up for tourists, you know, no like restrooms or any type of tourist infrastructure in the area. When I used to work at the beach, this past year, 2018-2017, we were getting a lot of calls of visitors going out into the rural areas and getting swept off the cliffs into the ocean. And, you know, a lot of them didn't make it. Some of them made it. But in the last 1 or 2 years, it was a lot more extensive than I had ever seen in my 17 years of working the beach. How many people were, you know, going up on the edge of the cliffs and then because of the high surf or whatever, getting swept off into the ocean, and not everybody made it out alive. So, you know, I mean, part of it is Maui Revealed telling our tourists places to go that have never been traditionally publicized. And part of it, too, is private property as well. So there's, you know, trespassing going on. And, you know, a lot of the safety videos or things, to me, are a little bit tame in comparison to what I used to see out there on the front lines. You know, they obviously, you don't want to scare people away if you're in the tourism industry, but it is kind of incumbent upon us to let them know the reality of the dangers, and that, you know, not everybody makes it back from their vacation alive.
Well, you know, Kauai Visitors Bureau came out with their vision and said that we think our capacity is at 25,000, and they often exceed that number.
Our general plan, I think, was the goal was to have tourism not be more than, I think, 30% of the general population at any given time, and I believe most of the time we do exceed that. I don't think that, you know, the general perspective from the Tourism Authority or the Maui Visitors Bureau is to slow down in the promotion and advertisement of Maui. So there is a little bit of a disconnect going on there. To me, we possibly can shift some funding, you know, from advertising Maui to sustaining what we have that's good about tourism here. You know, we don't really want to overpopulate our roads, our beaches, and, you know, maybe think of promoting off-season times more than, you know, the traditional school break times. I don't endorse cutting all the funding from Maui Visitors Bureau, because they do also help when we had the hurricanes or when the Pali Road is shut down or things like that. They do coordinate with the hotels and the guests on how to handle that. But, you know, another thing to think about, like when we had Hurricane Lane and there was that huge fire in our district, I was still working in the ocean safety under the fire department, and a lot of tourists had been evacuated to the civic center, and I spoke with one gentleman who had left his hotel because it was oceanfront and the forecast of the huge storm surge, so he went to the first shelter up Lahaina Luna Road at one of the schools. Then the fire came, and so he got evacuated from that shelter to the civic center. And by the time I came in to work, there was another fire north of the civic center, and then he had been evacuated from a fire on the south side of the civic center, and he was worried that he was going to be caught between the two fires. And, you know, we really didn't have enough shelter for our population. Everybody off of Lahaina Luna Road had been evacuated, Ka'anapali, Laniapoku. And so, you know, as we were driving around doing our patrols, there were just people everywhere in the parking lots. And at that time, we were still facing a Category 3 hurricane. And people had been evacuated from their homes, evacuated from their initial shelters. Some of my friends got evacuated twice. They evacuated from their home in Lahaina Luna stayed at a friend at Lania Poco's or Ka'anapali, and then they got evacuated from there. So, you know, also to take into consideration is if we're inviting all these visitors to come, that we're ultimately responsible for their safety once they're here. And, you know, these types of natural disaster events are getting more and more frequent. It is good, I think, for us, you know, to plan to work together on any type of natural disaster.
That was Maui County Councilmember Tamara Palton talking about not losing sight of what we need to do as we invite tourists to our island home, and keeping them safe during disasters. If you get a chance to see a silver sword in bloom, make sure you snap a picture. The rare plant is only found on the Hakala Summit area on Maui and Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa on the Big Island. Now, what's even more fascinating is that each volcanic mountain has its own unique type of silver sword. On Maui, the plant is unique to all the world on Maui and is considered to be, by many, the most beautiful. On Hawaii Island, the silver sword subspecies is known as sanwisense. It's very similar to the Haleakala silver sword, but its flower head is a bit narrower and it tends to yield fewer flowers. But all of these plants are part of the Agirosiphium, a small genus of plants in the sunflower family. And congratulations to David Hoppy Cruz of Waipahu, who happens to work in conservation. He got the answer right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Pilar Jennings, author of Mixing Minds. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the power of relationship in psychoanalysis and Buddhism.
Sunday morning at 11.
Bodies in Motion, How to Remove the Barriers for the Disabled, Getting Out of a Wheelchair and into Action. Take a listen to a clip of an upcoming production at the University of Hawaii entitled Integral Bodies. Now, the production is focused on inclusive dance and challenges stereotypes about disabled bodies.
I don't know, I just feel like, I guess, self-conscious in a way.
Sometimes I feel kind of invisible because I'm older.
People tell me, do not compare myself to other people. That's just the way how society works.
I really try to just accept who I am, what I look like.
A human being trying to make a way in life.
Choreographer Alito Alessi is in town to work with UH students and talk up what's possible for an underserved community. Alessi is a Guggenheim and the American National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship recipient.
There are two things that actually got me started in the particular field. First of all, my generation of dancers and choreographers, which was the late 60s, early 70s, always talked about all people could dance, but nobody ever did anything about it. So in 1987, I finally realized that I was one of those hypocrites who's not doing anything about the philosophy they talk a lot about. And so I created a workshop called Dance for Anybody to see what would happen. And 100 people came to the very first workshop. So it seemed like a pretty good idea, even though at the time I wasn't really prepared for what has now become the danceability method. I didn't really know what to do. I just thought it was a good thing to do. The other thing that has had an influence on my work, although at the time of beginning it, I didn't really realize, was that I had 3 people with disabilities in my family. They weren't really, I never considered them, like, for example, I never thought, oh, that's my disabled mother. It was like, that's my mom. She just happens to have a wheelchair. And that's my sister. She had polio. And that's my father's uncle. He's just a fun-loving guy, you know. And all 3 of them had disabilities. And so, in a way, danceability kind of found me. And the philosophy of danceability is that you accept people as they are and you move forward from that position.
But it sounds like people were really hungry for this type of acknowledgement.
Well, you know, I think most people at the time didn't really realize, and still is true, the value of the work. Like, when you say people were really hungry, I think mostly you think about people with disabilities wanting to have more access or equal access in a democratic society. But the truth is that it's a mutual learning scenario that benefits every person involved, no person learning more than someone else. So it's not really work for the disabled. It's work for all people, with the belief that what happens in a diverse society, which is honest reflection of itself, is where the most learning happens and where the most valuable information about relationship and community can evolve to facilitate creating true democracy.
I know somebody who was in a wheelchair temporarily who said it was like I became invisible.
That's absolutely true. I mean, in relationship to this project that I'm about to do, people with various forms of disability become invisible and have no access to a lot of things, including relationships, but in particular in relationship to this project, no access to artistic expression. Their physicality is often expected to just be functional and non-expressive. And so the hierarchy, the sort of systematic oppression of people with disabilities prevents them from being involved in many kinds of things, including artistic expression. And so in all walks of life, it's true. People with disabilities, on one level, they're not really looked at or respected or seen. People see the chair or the devices, and often a lot of attitudes, I think paralyzed attitudes, I would say, are that if you see a person with a disability, you assume you know a lot about them. And generally, those are not very positive thoughts. The danceability is trying to sort of erase some of those assumptions that go along with the way people perceive people they know nothing about and replace experiences for assumptions. Once you're in a room with a mixed abilities group of people, that means people with any kind of disability and any kind of able-bodied person from various forms of professional walks of life, if you might say, they soon realize that there's a lot to be gotten from the relationships.
Now, here in Hawaii, aerial yoga or aerial dance has kind of taken off. I would imagine that there'd be lots of opportunities for folks with disabilities to do these things, to, you know, get on a silk and do incredible things in the air.
Yeah, with the right kind of support and I think also the right kind of guidance and teaching, it could be amazing. Because the one thing is, when you work in a mixed abilities group, you can't really use the same language that you're familiar to working with. So, like, danceability has created a specific all-inclusive language of ways of to be able to teach all people the same information using the same language. And most forms, like aerial yoga or whatever, they have a language that's been developed for primarily able-bodied people. And there's some really specific things about the use of language to make it really not only give them an experience, but give them an opportunity to learn the same way everyone else learns.
So what do we need to do to make this accessible to our young people?
Well, what we've been doing is we have a lot of children, different kinds of children programs. So we perform with disabled and able-bodied performers in the schools. We also have parent and children classes or adult and children classes. We sometimes set up classes for disabled and able-bodied children a lot. Sometimes we work in institutions where there are just disabled children, and we try to work with the educational system to figure out ways of programming in physical education with both disabled and able-bodied kids together. I mean, that's really an important thing that you bring up, is that ultimately children don't have the prejudice and the assumptions that adults have about people with disabilities, and kids in their early part of their life are just fine with working with disability and working with disabled kids. And as they grow up, that separation gets greater and greater. But if they had more opportunity to work together continuously, not only as young kids and then it goes away, that would be a great facility for society. It's not only like, how can we benefit disabled children, it's about how can we benefit all people, and with the knowledge and wisdom that we get from an equal exchange of humanity, we take that education and that information into community building and to basically orientation towards building society. In my work, I believe that society has disabilities and that people are people. You know, it doesn't really matter what a person's condition is. It matters how are they able to function in society.
So you've been all over the country with this concept. What's
I've
happening?
I've been all over the world.
Yes.
We have 600 trained certified staff in 45 countries. I was just, Danceability International was just chosen as one of 10 global organizations that has been honored last in the United Nations, where we got to make presentations and speak about the work that we are doing and how it can actually help change the world. And at that conference, where we received an award from what's called the Zero Project and the Ashoka Foundation, there were 82 nations represented.
Is there anything that you've seen that you were particularly touched by as you've gone to different countries?
Well, I mean, I think that things are very much the same in most places, although some cultures are a little bit more advanced. The United States is a little bit more advanced. The northern Scandinavian countries are. But the thing that touches me the most is when you go to a culture like in Mongolia or Indonesia, where you have people with disabilities who never leave their home. Or if they get out of their home, they can't get in a bus. Or if they can get some from one place to another, they can't get in a building anywhere. I mean, recently when I was sponsored by the State Department to go to Mongolia and train people there, and there was a 13-year-old girl in my class who had never been in a social environment beyond her house. And so those things, I mean, are a little bit shocking. And then another thing that's happened recently, I was just in Ambato, Ecuador, where a mother brought her child who literally was like in living coma, alive and breathing, but no one knew how his mind worked or if it worked. But yet, through the methodology of my work, we're able to really be involved with, like I said, all people. And in the group that I was working with, someone asked the question, they said, well, why do you work with him? His name was Martin. Because he doesn't even know if we're with him. And I said, you see his mother over there, how happy she is? That happiness is contagious. So in the method, I literally mean all people, in that we have a system, a practical recipe book that we can give people so that you can identify what it is that you need to know to establish what we call a common denominator. So how can you begin something together and isolate nobody? Because we see the problem not what is someone's condition, but what and how are they isolated and separated from the rest of society? And we try to eliminate that isolation.
So really, though, you also then give them a freedom. You know, if they're trapped in a body that is has limited mobility, you kind of give them this freedom of expression to move.
Yes, you know, in a way you don't really understand what that might be for that individual who we don't really know how their or if their mind works. But the people that relate to them find a whole new self, part of themselves that also facilitates them in their personal liberation, because you can't liberate anyone else unless you liberate yourself. So
we grow together.
Yes, exactly.
That was Danceability Artistic Director Alito Alessi, who's in Honolulu to give a talk, All Bodies Speak. It actually starts this afternoon, 4 p.m., in the Earl Ernst Lab Theater at UH Manoa. It's a prelude to theater and dance main stage production, a season production entitled Integral Bodies. That production runs April 5th through April 14th.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
On the next Fresh Air.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
We mark the 50th anniversary of the publication of Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, by listening back to our interview with Puzo and our interview with Francis Ford Coppola about adapting the novel into the film. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Well, that wraps it up for this week. Up ahead, two call-in shows. We plan to talk to HART Executive Director Andrew Robbins about the latest developments around rail. And we focus on the Little Red Fire Ant invasion later in the week. Sound off on any of these topics by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congrusby. The backyard theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up The Conversation.